security isn't about just looking at the logs and things like that. It's about knowing what's going on around you. It's having the communications and being able to talk to people and translate. What we do in security can be very complicated. It can be very confusing because it's not always the same.
This is the Future of Cyber Risk podcast, brought to you by Team Cymry. I'm your host, David Monnier, fellow at Team Cymry. Let's jump right into today's episode.
Hey, everyone, and thanks for listening to another episode of the Future of Cyber Risk podcast. Today, I'm speaking with David Lingenfelter, Vice President of Information Security at Penn Entertainment. David, thanks for chatting with us today.
Thank you, David, for having me.
Our pleasure. So, David, what we'd like to get started with our guests is kind of like a brief intro. Why don't you tell us some about who you are, where you came from, and how you got here?
Sure. So, as you said, I'm with Penn Entertainment. Been here for just over 7 years. Came in to build security program and really help the company expand. We've expanded tremendously since I've been here, acquiring more casinos, going into the digital online space with sportsbook and sports betting. So a lot has changed and the company saw that happening. So wanted to build up a security program. Prior to that, I was with IBM for a few years as part of an acquisition that was FiberLink, which made the mobile device management product called MAS 360. Ran security for FiberLink probably almost 15 years, plus another three with IBM, getting the product onboarded into the IBM security cloud. So long time doing security prior to FiberLink, which takes me before the change of the millennia to the 1900s. I was still doing security back then for a few years. Security consulting is how I really got started in this. So dabbled in a little bit of everything very early on in what we call the modern cybersecurity landscape, and then built some cloud solutions with FiberLink and IBM, and now here at Penn.
Awesome. Yeah. So don't feel bad, David. I also am a practitioner from the 1900s.
Yeah. I just like saying that because it makes everybody think, wow, you've been doing this forever.
Yeah. No, I'm going to add that to my bit as well, because that is pretty funny. I hadn't that way. So a lot of folks, when they think gaming, when they think of the term gaming, they immediately think of video games, and they completely overlook, which I would dare to say, the original gaming, which is gambling. So why don't you tell us some about what does the day-to-day look like for someone who's responsible for systems that are literally holding money?
Oh boy, I wish there was a standard day-to-day. I think every security practitioner would love to have a standard day-to-day, but overall, I mean, every day you go into work, learning something new, expecting to learn something new. A lot of data analytics. We have a lot of systems out there that pulling information from our systems and from our networks. So there's a lot of data analytics, a lot of education. So a really big, important part of a successful cybersecurity program is making sure everybody around you understands, whether it's the security team or the risk team or the legal team or the end users, the consumers of all of our technology in-house. Everybody's got to be educated. So spend a lot of time doing education awareness, spend a lot of time learning. Technology's changing like crazy. The threat landscape is changing. So really a day in the life for me is, I almost feel like I'm in school, learning and teaching all at the same time. But that to me is an important part of it. And then sure, basically the team around me is bringing me information and we're talking and collaborating to see, is that a risk? Is that a threat? Is there something we need to be doing more about? But that's pretty much it.
So the adversaries that you're facing, right, they are slightly different than what you would think of as kind of your internet threat, right, where they have IP-only access. In your case, you know, you have a large physical access presence as well. I would assume casinos are mostly loaded with physical gaming apparatuses. How do you guys go about keeping aware or keeping up to date with things that are so, for lack of a better word, I guess, proprietary largely? How do you guys manage to maintain a security posture about something that you have so little, I guess, control over, right? Because the whole apparatus comes to you from your supply chain, essentially, right? I imagine you guys aren't having PCBs built for you and things like that. I would imagine the games are made by another person and then they make their way to you. And now you have to kind of manage this thing. What are some of the challenges you face there?
Yeah. So on the physical side, yes, casinos traditionally thought of security as brick and mortar, physical security with cameras and guards and everything else, and locked down certain things like the cash room and things like that from a physical perspective. But as the technology advanced and became more computerized and have more computer backends, there's complications there, but it's done through, again, a lot of conversations with our vendors, but also a lot of network design where there's different network segments, isolation within the network, segmentation within the network, and then access controls, making sure that people have access who need access and others are not able to get there. So it's a lot of planning, a lot of thinking of how are these systems going to be used? What do they need to connect to? And then making sure it's limited as to what can be done with them.
Sure. So I would imagine you have one of the most complicated, 802.1x is the MAC authentication. I imagine you have one of the most complicated 802.1x implementations in the Americas, I would imagine.
I'm sure there's more complicated than we are. Yeah, it's not simple.
That's funny. So speaking as a practitioner, and given kind of your unique perspectives of having both cyber and FizzSec, both related to the same asset, right? What are some things that, in your opinion, a lot of folks get wrong? So either miscalculations or misunderstandings.
That makes sense. And just to clarify, the security at Penn is divided into two teams. There's the physical security and the digital security. Regulations state that you can't be both. So I don't really manage the physical. Obviously, I talk with our security teams at the properties, but there is a separation there from just a structural perspective. But one of the big things that I see, and I've seen this at a lot of companies that I've worked for, is just underestimating the scale, what it takes to do an implementation, to implement a new technology, or to implement a change throughout an environment. So the topology is very decentralized. So we've got a lot of different networks, and to make a change that impacts that many networks and that many segments, a lot of people underestimate the amount of time and the amount of effort that it's going to take to do that.
Mm-hmm. And because you have the regulatory components, is there like a similar to in healthcare, for example, they have a very rigorous change management process. Like when somebody wants to go patch the MRI systems, right? They don't just go in and schedule downtime and do this patch, right? There's all kinds of testing involved because the machines themselves are dangerous. Are those also factors for you guys due to regulations?
Yeah. And on top of that, the regulations themselves are decentralized. So casinos are run by regulations at the state level. So if we're in 25 states, we have at least 25 different regulations.
Ah, okay.
So that adds to the complexity as well. But certainly the states are interested in specific systems that we have. And so those are more regulated and more controlled. And there's more processes around those when it comes to changes. But that also changes state by state.
Okay. And just out of curiosity, for those regulatory bodies at the state level, does that include things like code audit? Like, do they have people who can come and say, like, show us your slot machine source code? And like, if a company is having casinos market their machine, say, like one of the gaming company, like the manufacturers that make these gaming consoles, are they obliged to, like, for example, give up their source code to states that request it? And how common is that? And sorry, I know this is like totally secondary, but you are in an interesting space.
Yeah, no, it is very interesting. And it was a big learning curve when I came here. But yes, so there are requirements to go have the applications, whether they're mobile applications or the physical applications, go through security testing by the states. There are companies that are certified to do that. And again, the requirements, the rigor is slightly different state by state.
Right. Interesting. Because it's not something you think of when you imagine, you know, the state, mostly everybody thinks of tax audit. You don't imagine somebody going and like doing code audit line by line type of stuff. But I mean, I could see why they'd have to, right? Because otherwise you're just taking people's word for it. And as we know, that doesn't always go well. So what skills do you think for practitioners, whether they are headed into a leadership role or not, regardless of that, but what skills do you think are most critical for security practitioners to succeed today?
There's so many technical skills that could come up here, but to me, the most important is probably the soft skills. Security isn't about just looking at the logs and things like that. It's about knowing what's going on around you. It's having the communications and being able to talk to people and translate. What we do in security can be very complicated. It can be very confusing because it's not always the same. It changes day to day. So being able to translate that and explain to people why yesterday we were asking you for one thing and today we're asking you for something else, really those soft skills, those communications, being able to listen to people, help educate people, learn from people, that's really going to make or break a security team.
Yeah, absolutely. So in your space, given you would have a very diverse set of employees, right? Like you have people who are directly involved with the finance, but then you also have all the hospitality staff and all of the gaming staff, which the dealers and whatnot, which are different than the servers and whatnot. Then I assume some of your casinos also have hotels. So there's all of those staff, all of the access controls involved and all that stuff. In that piece, and you had mentioned this at the beginning of our session here, you had said that education was a huge tool that you use there. Given how diverse your user base is, and again, this isn't to disparage anybody who's in food service industry, but they aren't necessarily accustomed to password management stuff that somebody who works in an accounting firm might be, right? Because they get it all the time, whereas the other people, they may have just one code they enter into the point of sale system, and that's the extent of what they think of when they think of their passwords and whatnot. So given how diverse your user base is, what have you seen as far as things that work for education to get people on board so that their head is in the right space so they understand, you know, why the security team exists? What does education look like for you guys?
Sure. It's a very wide range. So we do the basics that I think everybody should be doing, which is we start with phishing simulations. So we do those periodically, and those are followed up with some awareness training videos or some awareness campaign afterwards, explaining why that we did the campaign. There's also other, we built a bunch of online training modules, but we also have group level conversations where we will have a video broadcast like this and be presenting to whether it's people in finance or people on the hospitality side, what some of the risks are, what some of the threats are, and why, as those people in those positions, they may be the target. So it may not be so much trying to get to the financial systems. It may be just trying to get information from people about who's at the property at what time, what does things look like at the property, more of the social engineering aspect. So we have the conversations with these units and with the different teams explaining what some of the recent threats are. And we pull them from the front page, and then we explain to them how it's real in our world as well.
Interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. The people coming and going from the locations would also be of interest, in not just to rob them, but to understand patterns of their life and their interests. There's definitely all kinds of juicy stuff that could be there. So for your industry, what kind of challenges and, I guess, headwinds do you think the next couple of years are going to bring you guys? Like, for example, how has ransomware affected your guys' industry? And do you see threats like that to be the next 5 years? Or do you guys face other unique stuff?
Ransomware remains a threat. Certainly, it's been around for several years now and remains one of the bigger threats, I think, to most industries, especially industries that have large customer bases or large databases of people that they want to steal that information and then ransom that information. Obviously, that's going to remain a priority for us, and has been for quite a while. I think as the industry changes over the next few years, more online activity is going to be taking place. So more of a transition from just the brick and mortar and the physical side to more of the digital side, whether it's within the casino with hospitality apps or whether it's with gaming apps. I see more online transition. So more of a focus on how do we protect that information as well.
Okay, awesome. So again, kind of not to assume you have any part in this per se, but I'm curious to know your take on the MGM fiasco and Caesars. Both hit the same weekend. I don't know if it was by the same people or not. I never did get the follow-up at the time. I did read some speculation that they thought it may be the same people responsible, but I know you aren't, you know, you're not somebody who works for them or had anything to do with it, but you are in that industry. So I would imagine you guys paid particular attention to all that news and whatnot. What was your take on all of that? And was there anything that as you read the news that you thought, oh man, I bet they didn't dot, dot, dot. And what would be that thing?
Not going to get into what I think other companies did or didn't do, but certainly it was an eye-opener for the industry. And it was, I mean, both of those companies were victims to something that happens to every industry, whether it's the hospitality industry or hospitals or finance. These types of attacks happen. It's no industry is immune from it. So I think, again, a lot of learning opportunity for everybody across the board, a lot of awareness. And for us, a lot of conversation came up in. Conversation is always good because that helps go back to the original comment of awareness and education is key. So from our standpoint, while not a good event, and again, both of those companies were victims to this, it turned out for us to be a great learning opportunity.
Sure. I would imagine that that's the case. So in my past, I helped launch one of the information sharing and analysis centers. They're referred to as ISACs. There's one for healthcare, there's one for energy, there's one for retail, there's one for IT, there's one for finance, et cetera. So each sector that's deemed critical was authorized to launch one of these ISACs. And I helped launch one for the Research Education Networking ISAC. And one of the things that I thought was very interesting was the hesitance to assist each other from universities when they would have incidents. They didn't want to tell the other universities what had happened and what they learned and what the root cause, and kind of like the most important thing you could tell somebody, right? Like how to avoid it from happening to them. But they were very concerned about kind of the reputational impact of, like, if they go talking too much about this, it might make them shine a bad light on them and whatnot. And we spent a great deal of time trying to build trust community around it. So at least at the practitioner level, people were willing to exchange IOCs with each other. Like, you don't have to say what in your network was hit by something, but if this is the domain it's going to reach out to once it gets hit, share that domain. You know, like, folks know these IOCs that they could look for. Is there such a thing in the gaming industry? Do you guys have the opportunity to do, let's call it, direct collaboration? Because you're not really competing per se with each other. I mean, you are, but it's kind of a different type of competition because someone can go to more than one casino, right? Unlike a university, once you enroll at a university, you're kind of there for the next couple of years. So I see why they would be super concerned about, like, the reputation, but I would think that consumers would be happy to know that the places where they go for entertainment are working together, right? To kind of solve stuff. Do you guys have trust groups like that? Is it a thing? And is there maybe an opportunity to make one?
Yeah, so I remember a time, and I don't know what time frame you're talking about when you were building the forums that you were in, but I do remember a time when companies were afraid to say something because it would tarnish reputation or it would bring a bad light to them and stuff. I think a lot of that's changed over the last several years. I've been doing this for a long time, but I would say over the last several years, the lines of communication have gotten better in most industries. And I think some of the new legislation coming down from the government is helping some of that with the transparency when there is a breach or when there is an event. So I do think a lot of that's changed. And again, it goes back to the soft skills of just having conversations. So there is communication between the casino companies, obviously, like any industry, and then there are limits. We do talk and we do reach out to each other once in a while, and there are forums that we get onto and share some information, absolutely. And I think that's definitely been a change in my career. Early in my career, it was, don't ever let anybody know anything that's happened to your company because it'll destroy us. I think there's been enough awareness made that no company is immune from getting breached or getting compromised or being attacked. So I think people have matured to the point where they are willing to talk about it to some degree. While there's still competitiveness in every industry, I think it's getting better.
Okay. Yeah. To be fair, the time I'm talking about is probably 18 years ago, almost the late 1900s. The early double aughts.
Yes. After we all survived the whole Y2K thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the trick was just don't change the time on your microwave in the first place.
So there you go.
So final question for you, being mindful of our time here. So we like to always ask folks for three takeaways, three pieces of actionable advice for our listeners, whether they be someone who has newly found themselves in a security leadership role, whether it be somebody whose task it is to look and consider what risk and how risk impacts their business. Think the full gamut of people who concern themselves with cyber risk. What's your three pieces of actionable advice?
First is know your business, know your industry, learn it inside and out, talk to different business unit leaders throughout your company to see what they do, what their day-to-day is, understand where their concerns and their risks are. So I think that's actionable. Just meet everybody, know everybody in the different needs, the different business units within your company, and not necessarily even lead, but just talk to the practitioners too and understand what's their day-to-day look like and what are their concerns. Second, make strong relationships with your legal and your risk teams. It's important for security to have those relationships because there's so many things now coming out from a regulation standpoint and requirements from risk. You mentioned earlier cyber insurance. You're going to have to go through and talk with all these teams. So make sure that you're forging strong relationships with them because they're going to get information that they're going to want to share with you once they understand that you're part of the team. And then the third one, clients, regulations are changing. Study them, stay up on them. They're changing faster now than I've ever remembered them in the past. And it's a good thing because it's bringing more light to security. It's bringing more focus into the cybersecurity space. But at the same time, it's making sure that your company is following those regulations and is able to follow those regulations. And from a security practitioner standpoint, being able to translate those regulations so that other people in the industry or in the company can understand what they actually mean.
Sure. And I do apologize. I have to add a half question to your last answer there.
Okay.
Because I'm super curious, because you're in a very unique spot, both because it's so regulated, but also because it's so driven after, because everybody wants to break the bank, if you will, or break the house, I guess. So you got like multiple different types of risks going on. It's very interesting to me. So speaking about regulatory impact or pressure, let's call it that, how has that changed the business risk appetite for the industry? Obviously, I'm not asking you to speak specifically as to Penn's position on the business risk, but at some point, I would imagine the regulatory downsides become more toothy than not, right? So at some point, the fear of getting caught not protecting yourself is worse than the attack. Like that's kind of the end game for, if you think of a regulatory stick, right? Because that's what that stuff is really designed to do, is you go do the right thing, otherwise we're going to come do something to you, right? How has that changed the gaming industry? Like as regulatory commissions wake up to kind of electronic realities, right? They're going, changing their regulatory requirements on you, which eventually makes it to the gaming people as well, I would imagine. So you've got all these new inputs. How has that changed kind of the risk appetite for the industry?
The gaming industry has been heavily regulated for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always been the regulation. So the new regulations, I don't think are changing the appetite drastically. I mean, there's adjustments and pivots that need to be made. But from that perspective, the states have required certain things from the casinos for quite a long time. And they've been very diligent about making sure we're following the regulation. So I think it's more of adding on, making sure that different parts of the business that maybe weren't as in scope or in focus for the regulators are now coming into focus. Overall, I don't know that that is really adjusting, or it's not really pivoting our risk. It's adjusting it certainly, but we were pivoting and going, wow, what do we need to do differently now as a company? We're going to continue as a company. We're already a highly regulated industry.
Honestly, yeah, the reason why I ask is because I would imagine, let's just use playing cards, for example, as the relative comparable here. So relative to playing cards, a slot machine is a time machine, right? A slot machine is a very digital slot machine. It's a very complicated thing relative to a deck of cards, right? So there had been a time where regulation on the new modern methods, right, were taking in the analog rules and kind of starting from there. But then as people started to better understand technology, I could see where the regulation components of it start to get much more toothy, much more involved, much more, because frankly, now they know to know, right? Because when the things first started, I mean, we'll just go ask almost anybody on the street how any of this electronic stuff works, and they have no idea. Some of which are totally wholly reliant on them, in electronic insulin pumps, for example, are keeping people alive, but they have literally no idea how it works, you know, at all. So obviously not the same example, but I would imagine that over time, the regulators, you know, as they realize like, oh, how all this stuff works in detail as they're making those changes, I would think that that could be like a full-time job. Maybe the changes aren't so much now, but I would imagine, like in particular, when the kind of electronic gambling really took off, what's that been 20 years ago now or something like that? I bet that was a big eye opener for probably all kinds of people, were like, wait a minute, now what do we need to do? You know, what is IP or what is TCP/IP? I would imagine that was big change for folks. So I was just curious to know if that's still happening.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely happening. And it's, again, an awareness thing where the regulators realize there's a new technology, or to your point, there's technology behind the technology. And then it's up to us to help make sure they understand how it's being used, what it's being used for, what it's not being used for, and that there's ways to put controls in place. So it's conversational. Typically, it's very conversational with the regulators to help them understand what the new technology is, mm-hmm. and that to understand from them what their requirements are so that the implementation can be done in such a way that everybody ends up happy and winning.
Interesting. So, and then final question, how do we win on these machines?
I'm afraid I can't do
it. Just put more money in, right? That's
sure.
The point. Anyway, so David, thanks so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure to chat with you. For our folks out there that are listening that may want to either follow up with you directly, should they have a unique question specific to something you may know, or to see what you have going on, do you have social media, LinkedIn, this type of stuff? If so, if it's okay with you, we can put it in the show notes.
Sure, absolutely. I'm active on LinkedIn. Just my name, David Lingenfelter. That's really where I do most of my socializing this time.
Sure. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining us, David. Hope you have a good rest of your week.
Great. Thank you. Great being here.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Future of Cyber Risk podcast, brought to you by Team Cymry. For the latest episodes, please visit team-cymry.com or search Future of Cyber Risk on your podcast platform of choice. Thanks, and we'll catch you on the next episode.